Vulture capitalism, that is a world where the corporation becomes more powerful than the country. It's a world of cashed-up disaster profiteers, war contractors and aid leeches. And it's a world where collusion of private interests and the state have become seamless, a capitalism that has gone off the rails and, in fact, predatory. These are the ideas in a book by Anthony Lowenstein, Australian journalist and filmmaker. Among his best-selling books are My Israel, and he writes for Haaretz, The Guardian, Sydney Morning Herald, Huffington Post, and others. And in this book, he goes in search of predatory capitalism from Papua New Guinea to Pakistan, Haiti, Afghanistan. Who is involved? Why does it happen? Linguist Noam Chomsky writes, it is courageous reporting, illuminated with perceptive analysis. It's called Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. And I asked Anthony to give us a brief explanation of just what vulture capitalism is.
I wanted to write a book about issues that I thought weren't getting enough press in Australia, in New Zealand and around the world. And I was inspired by Naomi Klein's book. She's a Canadian writer and journalist who wrote a book called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism a few years ago. And she looked at the role, particularly since the 1970s, in various countries around the world, including Iraq, Chile, the US and elsewhere, of how the corporation became more powerful than the state, and that in certain situations, man-made disasters or others, corporations and certain interests use those opportunities to push through very extreme policies. So I was inspired by that. And the last 3 years have spent time, as you introduced me, to say, going around the world to speak to various people in these countries, look at the roles of privatized war, detention centers, aid, mining, and those kind of questions. So we often hear about the war in Afghanistan, but we hear less about the fact that a lot of the forces that the US and other countries are using is private, is outsourced, is run for profit. We so often hear about immigration or detention, but we don't often as much talk about the fact that the detention centres in the UK, in the US, in my country, Australia, and increasingly, I might add, in New Zealand, prisons particularly, are run for profit by certain corporations. And the problem with this is that often there's a lack of accountability, there's a lack of transparency, and both sides in this equation, the government and the corporation, are happy with that because they don't want a great deal of accountability. And I'm not saying, just to clarify, that if, for example, a detention centre is run by the state, it's therefore utopia. Not at all. But in so many examples that I show around the world, the lack of accountability causes huge human rights abuses and, for that matter, I think a democracy deficit.
Your book actually starts close to home for you, exploring the issue of the private prison industry. And you travel to the middle of nowhere, to the Curtis Immigration Detention Centre run by the Australian government and the British multinational called Serco. Now, we know about Serco in New Zealand also. They've run all of Australia's detention centres since 2009. And you write, quoting, I can't imagine a more isolated place to be detained. And I was thinking, it struck me as a dark irony, Anthony, that the continent of Australia itself was seen back in George and England, the world's most desolate prison. Tell us about this isolated place.
One of the things Australia's been doing for actually in some ways 15 or 20 years, and it's only got worse since then, is of a belief that immigration or asylum seekers, when they're coming mostly by boat from Indonesia, or that's massively slowed down to even stopped in the last year or so, is to put people in the middle of nowhere, to put people in desert camps. So, for example, the one I spend time in is called Curtin in Western Australia. Very isolated, very remote, very hot in the middle of summer, quite cold in winter, run, as you say, by Serco, the British multinational. And the reality of that on the ground for asylum seekers in those centres is very grim. The medical conditions are poor. The ability to move around is poor. The lack of information from the government about their claim is very limited. And the effect of that, of course, this has been documented by report after report, including I have got some leaked information from a very senior Serco manager who remains at the company, who says that the company themselves know that they can't actually manage the contract. In other words, when they signed the contract with the Australian government in 2009, there were not many asylum seekers who were coming. There was a surge of boats coming from Indonesia from 2010 onwards. And the result of that is that a system has been so incapable to manage the huge numbers of people. And the effect is that you have huge mental trauma of the asylum seekers, but also the guards, the people who work for the company. One of the things that really open my eyes, and I guess I acknowledge my own prejudice here, is that people often who work for these kind of corporations, sometimes they're thuggish and sometimes they're racist, and I don't for a second defend that kind of behavior, but people often are thrown into very difficult circumstances. They are paid relatively well to go to remote places to work, to manage asylum seekers, and I think often they're not given any training or very limited training when, for example, they're faced with individuals who are committing suicide, who are self-harming. So Curtin in Western Australia is one example, but frankly, there are many others. There's Christmas Island, which is an island in the Indian Ocean 3 hours from Perth, in the middle of nowhere, quite a beautiful place, actually, and sells itself as a tourist island. But in fact, in the last roughly 7 or 8 years, it's been the home of a high-security prison for asylum seekers. And New Zealand listeners may have heard now and then about unrest at these kind of facilities if they followed Australian news. And there are, in the last, again, few years, there's now detention centres on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea and Nauru in the Pacific. All these places are run for profit. Yes, the government of the day runs the policy. They are dictating the policy. But the problem is, and I outline this in the book, is that when you have a corporation aiming to make profit, which of course is its aim, inevitably they will spend less money on resources, healthcare, training, inevitably, because of course if they spend more, they lose profit. And that's, I think, is the heart of the problem of this system, which is now globalized and it's coming to New Zealand.
Internally, a source said to you from Serco that it's called the human warehousing business.
Yeah.
Is it profitable?
Absolutely. Serco is one of the largest outsourcing companies in the world. It's British. The contract in Australia has been its most profitable, its largest contract. Now, I've actually spoken since that book came out, Prophets of Doom, to another individual who works for Serco, now based in the US, who told me that from their perspective, yes, it was hugely profitable, remains so. The contract, in fact, is currently up for re-tender, and we're going to find out soon whether Serco has maintained that contract. But it's very profitable, and it's profitable because the Australian government made a decision very unwisely to outsource all the centres onshore to one corporation, Serco. The centres offshore are run currently by Transfield, which is an Australian multinational. So very profitable, and the effect of that is that the kind of staff that they're employing, individuals often who are coming from prison backgrounds, have little or no training or understanding of the kind of mental trauma that the individuals who are coming seeking asylum will have. So often the people who I spoke to who work at these facilities in remote places, and some of them are in major cities in Perth, Darwin and Sydney and Melbourne, are traumatized because they themselves are realizing that, in fact, they're not given the training by Serco because Serco wants to increase its profits.
One thing that speaks to the heart of it as well, you talk about the active dehumanization of detainees. I mean, even the language of profit, your source said that they're described as moving products around instead of, well, actually that meant shifting detainees, moving products around.
Look, it's grim, and it's essentially people are seen as numbers, which is exactly like a high-security prison. So when various countries in the US or the UK or Australia, or for that matter in your country, New Zealand, talk about immigration as being somehow different to prisons, the fact is they've become remarkably similar. And having spent some time in prisons as a visitor rather than as an inmate in the last few years, I've seen that a lot of similarities between the systems, and in fact, increasingly, they're run by the same corporations. And the effect of that is that the corporation itself treats asylum seekers, who often are vulnerable, in the same way they would treat a murderer, a rapist, whatever it may be. And the staff who are employed by this corporation behaves in a similar way. And the effect is there's literally report after report by government agencies, human rights groups, in pretty much every country I've visited, and I'm doing some work for a new book, which will be out next year, on disaster capitalism in the US, UK and Greece and elsewhere, is that all these human rights reports pretty much find the same thing, namely unprecedented mental trauma of the individuals inside these centres. And the governments and the corporations know this.
But aren't they required, though, like in New Zealand, Serco, as an example, to pay heavy fines if they breach penalties or if they don't get the required outcome from the Australian or New Zealand governments?
this is one of the things that I discovered in this book, and this was partly through leaked documents from my Serco source and speaking to my Serco source, is that, yes, on paper, there is a very rigorous process of oversight. The contract that the Australian government signed with Serco in 2009 says, if Serco doesn't do this, if Serco doesn't do that, if an individual, for example, is abused or traumatised or escapes, Serco pays a fine. However, this is a very important however, in reality, the corporation and the state collude to make sure that that does not happen. There have been examples in the last years, yes, where Serco have paid fines, but often Serco managers high up are telling managers lower down who are based at the centres themselves, do not report incidents, because if you report incidents, the government will fine us. This is happening from the top, and it's happened in the current government, the previous government, and governments before. And I see this in other countries around the world. The effect is that when democracy, I think, is damaged, when you have got an inability or unwillingness of governments to actually fine the corporation because they themselves have outsourced to them. They need the company as much as the company needs the government.
I'm talking with a journalist and author, Anthony Lowenstein, on his new book, Prophets of Doom. Continuing the privatisation theme, privatisation as it relates to war. Now, you look at some of the private players that have been the recipients of state contracts, and this is where I find it fascinating. Why would a government not bolster its own forces, but rather outsource contracts to, for example, DynCorp, giving over $1 billion to assist America's efforts in building up the Afghan security forces? Why would a government do that?
On September the 10th, 2001, I have this quote in my book, the day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld, who was then the US Defense Secretary, gave a speech essentially saying that the greatest enemy that the American military faces is not terrorism, it's waste. I can't remember his exact words, but this essence being that we need to cut our cloth. We need to basically reduce the idea of the state doing all these services, everything from cleaning to providing food. 9/11 happens. Of course, we know what happened after that. America went into Afghanistan and then Iraq, and they've both been a disaster. But the reason the US government continually outsources these, they use the argument that it's cheaper and more efficient. And we shouldn't also forget the lobbying system in the US system itself is so effective that in many districts for congressmen and women, they are relying on private corporations to bolster their election war chests. It's not a conspiracy that's been written about for years. And the effect of that is that a great number of politicians are essentially very happy to outsource various services, not just intelligence, and people often don't realize that a lot of the intelligence that is being used, and clearly it's been pretty bloody awful in the last 10 years, is sourced from private corporations who are have a, I guess you'd almost say, a reason to exaggerate certain threats, because then the US government will keep on coming back for more. One of the things that has been less talked about, just even this year, the Iraqi army, many listeners will be aware, has completely collapsed in the face of the rise of ISIS in Iraq. And the argument was made that the US government, of course, was spending literally billions and billions and billions of dollars training this army. What's less talked about is that training often was being done by private corporations. That's the reality. So in Afghanistan now, many people fear that when the US pulls out mostly this year and pretty much entirely by 2016, what will happen to the Afghan army then? Is it going to whittle away if the rise of the Taliban? I think one of the things I look at in the book, the reasons why the corporation itself has been so effective in pushing an argument that says we can fight your wars, as into the US, more efficiently and better. Allow us to do the training. Allow us to hire underpaid South Asian workers to fly to Iraq and Afghanistan and make the food for your troops, wash your clothing. All those kind of issues are mostly outsourced now. And it's been a disaster for the individuals themselves, and often the lack of accountability of the behaviour of those contractors. People will know the name Blackwater in the last 7 or 8 years have caused massive carnage. And the problem, and I'll finish on this point, is that the US has been very happy to provide immunity to those contractors when they access war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, you can imagine what that does. Contractor X commits an alleged crime. He's then rarely tried in the country itself, flown out of the country, and then brought back to the US. And there are many, many examples.
So you're saying that contractors are subject to different rules and
absolutely,
if they were part of the state military personnel.
For
so,
sure.
So what happens, for example, if a contractor injures or kills someone?
There's been so many cases of that in the last 10 years, but in the majority of cases, and there are definitely exceptions, the contractor gets away with it. It's really as simple as that. There are many examples of Blackwater, for example, causing carnage in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the US government, the US State Department has assisted the company and individual leaving those countries and coming back to the US. There are a few exceptions. There's currently a trial that's been going on for a long time in the US of a number of Blackwater contractors who killed a lot of people in Baghdad a number of years ago, and they're basically filing charges of murder, and that's unclear how that's going to play out. That's a rare exception. I spent time in Afghanistan and spoke to a number of Afghans themselves whose families had been affected by Western-backed contractors, both Afghan and others, who literally saw these individuals cause chaos, kill people, injure people, maim people. There was little or no accountability in the war zone. And I should also just add, I'm not arguing that if the war was all run by the US government, that things would be fantastic in Iraq or Afghanistan either. I think there would be deep problems there as well. But when you add the level of contractors, which is rarely talked about in the press, the effect being that you have literally thousands upon thousands upon thousands of contractors. And when Obama, for example, discusses pulling out US troops or inserting US troops, what is not talked about are the number of contractors who go with that.
You say in the book, Anthony, that there are now more contractors than soldiers in Afghanistan. In the last quarter of 2012, there were over 109,000 contractors in Afghanistan, nearly double the number of US troops. My question is this a trend that is likely to continue, do you think?
Well, I should say, obviously, since those figures came out, the numbers have slightly changed, but it is roughly the same percentage, namely that I should just clarify that those contractors might not be always carrying a gun. They could be, as I said, someone who's washing clothes or, you know, being involved in making food for US troops. And often in those cases, there's a lot of examples of those individuals who are almost sold a lie in their home countries, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka and elsewhere, to come to Iraq and Afghanistan. Their passports are taken away from them. They can't leave. Many, many examples of these individuals who are essentially working as slaves in a war zone at very great risk. You ask, is it going to continue? Well, there's not much evidence that it won't, really. Obama, when he was coming into office in 2009, pledged to change and reverse these huge trends that have continued during the Bush administration. But like so many things, Obama has done very little. And in fact, he's increased the outsourcing to contractors in various countries. And we saw that in Libya in the last while when there was a US intervention in 2011, and that's of course ended in disaster. And the fear is that this will continue because the US, and this is Democrat and Republican, see the possibility of fighting more wars on more continents when you can basically have both contractors and the military. And we shouldn't forget that the US particularly loves to use contractors at some of the most sensitive counterterrorism policies, often namely kidnapping and assassination, for this very good reason. There's less accountability. In theory, if you are a US soldier, you are held accountable in the US Congress. That's the theory anyway. A contractor essentially is not. And there are many examples. Jeremy Scahill, the American journalist who's written a lot about this over the years, including in Dirty Wars, his great book and film of last year, details the role of those kind of companies in pursuing very harsh, arguably illegal actions around the world, which the US is happy to allow because they don't want to do it themselves.
I'm speaking with Anthony Lowenstein, author of Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. I've got an interesting quote here, Anthony. I'll just read it. We arrive at the Jaba River, close to the centre of the mine site, a waterway that's filled with glowing blue copper tailings, the result of many years of Bougainville Copper Limited dumping chemicals and heavy metals into the area. We watch as dozens of men, women and children pan the river for gold in a desperate attempt to earn a living amongst batteries, tyres, weeds, toxic water runs. Panning is their only form of income. And one of the striking things about the places that you write about is that they often have incredible resources, but are terribly poor. And Papua New Guinea is one of them, as you say, the resource curse. Tell us about going into this massive mine pit. Tell us your experiences.
Bougainville, for those who don't know, is a province in Papua New Guinea to our north, to Australia's north. And Bougainville was home to one of the world's largest mines called Panguna, and run by both Rio Tinto and Bougainville Copper Limited.
Massive too, wasn't it? 7 kilometres at its widest part.
Indeed. It basically opened in the 70s and closed in the late 80s. In short, locals rose up in resistance to what they saw, in my view, justifiably, against bad pay, bad conditions towards them, and huge pollution of their land and rivers. There was a civil war that lasted for about 10 years. Civil war mean there was locals on one side, and the other side was the Australian government, the Papua New Guinean government, and Bougainville Copper Limited itself. And in a very rare example of locals winning these kind of wars, Rio Tinto lost, but meaning that the mine shut down at a very, very high cost. There were up to 10 to 20,000 individuals who were killed, many of whom were civilians. And the pollution in Bougainville remains. And I've been there twice in the last 3 years. I'm working on a film about these issues as well, to do some shooting late last year. And what's remarkable is you go to Bougainville now, and Papua New Guinea is not in very good shape anyway, but in Bougainville itself, things are stuck in like in a time war. The main town near the mine, called Arawa, there's still burnt out petrol stations. They were burnt out 20 years ago. I mean, nothing has changed. And the fear, and the reason why I address this in my book, and I'm going to continue to write about it, is the fear is that the agreement that Bougainvillean rebels struck with the PNG government to end the war was that there'd be a referendum on their independence between 2015 and 2020. So in theory, from next year. And one of the conditions that many people are saying should be put on this kind of agreement is the mine must and should reopen. And the problem with that is, and ultimately it should be up to the people of Bougainville, of course, not people like me, but you see, and I've spent time in the pit, that the pollution and the chaos that was caused inside there against locals, against individuals, the Australian government's role in this is very, very dark. It supported the PNG government, it funded them, it armed them, it trained them. It failed miserably in pursuing its goal because the Bougainvillians won. And I guess I wanted to use the example of Papua New Guinea because we often hear about PNG as almost a quasi-failed state. WikiLeaks documents kind of prove that in some ways a few years ago, where there's a huge culture of corruption there. But Australia, for example, gives Papua New Guinea roughly $500 million of aid every year. And that's often tied to Australian companies being allowed to mine and, in my view, rape the kind of resources. So, yes, massively rich country, but incredibly poor. And you see this in place after place. Yeah.
How can countries like Papua New Guinea, often, as you say, seen as a failed state, could never get back on its own 2 feet? I mean, but massive resources, how can they do it? I see a piece of good news came out in 2012, the establishment of a sovereign fund that would save the huge wealth created through oil, gas and mineral exploitation in Papua New Guinea. Is that the answer?
It's one answer. I have to say that nothing much actually has happened to that since the announcement of it a few years ago, sadly. And other countries very much showed the way. In fact, I was just reading something today about Norway, which has a very interesting fund for its huge resources. Now, they're going to run out at some point, but every Norwegian citizen, in theory, is worth a lot of money because the Norwegian state made a very wise decision a number of years ago to try to save it for the future, whatever that may bring.
Why can Norway do it and Papua New Guinea can't? With similar resources?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think in short, it's because I would argue, and I argue this in the book, is that many outside forces, including the Australian government, and we shouldn't forget until 1975, PNG was an Australian colony. It only became independent in name 40-odd years ago. But in reality, PNG is not an independent country. It relies heavily on outside aid and development. It relies heavily on outside resource companies. And I think PNG, and I spent time with these people when I was there, are looking to sort of say, why is PNG's future solely based around exploiting resources? Why can't it be also around agriculture and other areas, which have huge possibilities there? I spent time with people who are doing that right now. The thing is, the outside forces in a country like PNG are far stronger than in Norway. Norway is seen as a stable democratic country, which it is, and PNG is not. And the ability for the PNG political elite over decades to be happy to be played by either Australia, or increasingly, as we see in many parts of the Pacific now, China. China's increasingly, as of course, to increase its scope of influence in the Pacific and elsewhere. And you see a lot of Chinese businesses, Chinese influence, Chinese infrastructure in PNG. I think there needs to be a direction coming from outside and within the country to respect the possibility of a truly independent country. PNG is independent only in name. That is the problem. In reality, in fact, it's really a reliant state on foreign aid, and Australia, I think, has a lot to answer for there.
Let's look at the definition of capitalism in your book, Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. And looking at that definition, an economic system where investment in and ownership of the means of production, distribution and exchange of wealth is made and maintained by private individuals or corporations as opposed to cooperatively or state-owned means of wealth. So I'm asking, is vulture capitalism something different again?
It's a good question. When the book came out, some people said, on the left at least, what's the difference between capitalism and vulture? Isn't that the nature of capitalism? Well, yes, to some extent, I think that's true. And I try to analyze that in the book. But I think there are differences. I think in the last even 6 years, we have seen in country after country the complete failure of a market system to actually adequately respond to a crisis that was caused arguably by the system itself. And in fact, there's an upcoming book out this month by the great Canadian writer Naomi Klein about climate change, which says this very point, that the idea that you can solve the climate crisis by market changes, market forces, is a lie, that one needs to take much greater action. And I think that's going to be a very provocative book that's out in a couple of weeks. One of the differences I think that I talk about in the book is that a corporation can exist and not exploit people, cannot necessarily make a choice to operate in Haiti or PNG or Afghanistan. Of course, you can operate in those countries. And I've spent some time with certain individuals and corporations who are doing invaluable work in all those countries, some for profit and some not. I'm not saying that because you're a corporation making profit, by definition, you're evil. Far from it. However, one of the problems I think with developing countries is that the idea somehow exists that if you're an NGO, non-government organization, you're benign. And I think we have this misguided belief in the West that if somehow you are an NGO operating in those countries, you are doing good work. And the reality in many countries is that people, the contracting business, especially in developing countries, allows the fact that it's so rarely assisting locals on the ground. I looked at this in all those places, and you find that most of the contracts are going to corporations based in the West. So in Haiti, for example, after the 2010 earthquake, there were billions and billions of dollars of aid pledged, particularly from the US. But the effect was that most of the contracts went to US corporations, and those corporations rarely, if ever, trained Haitians themselves. So to answer your question about capitalism, to me, I think capitalism can be, you know, on its own, at times it can be benign.
So your book is not anti-capitalist?
I think it's profoundly questioning the benefits of how capitalism is employed. Personally speaking, I would not call myself pro-capitalist, but at the same time, the book doesn't say, by definition, if you earn money from a corporation, you are a bad person. No, what I'm saying is the system is so far gone and so broken in all these countries, including our Western ones, that capitalism is the problem. And I think there needs to be a way. I'm not someone who says you can make capitalism kind of cuddlier or warmer or nicer. To me, I think there are so many examples in all these places and other ones I haven't mentioned where capitalism simply doesn't work. So is the book anti-capitalist? To an extent, I guess it is, but it doesn't really go that deep into that argument. It prefers to, rather than being a theoretical argument, to say, here are the examples of how we're told we are helping the world. We are told in the West that aid and development and mining and et cetera assists these countries. The fact is it does not, and here are the reasons why.
Anthony, you do a heck of a lot of travelling, and you write,
yes,
you really do, and I expect there's more to come. But you write that there were countless times during your travels when you felt helpless, overwhelmed by the stories put before me, in your words. And then there is a bigger question, the economic control over people's lives in these countries. What's the answer, and how do you keep on going when you see this total helplessness around the world?
I think one of the things that I've often done as a journalist, and I guess I've been professional for roughly just over 10 years now, is that I think journalism can do wonderful things. It can enlighten people. It can bring information. I mean, if you've just seen in the last few weeks, two very brave journalists who are, you know, beheaded in Iraq, who their work was valuable because they took risks that most other journalists did not, and they paid, of course, an incredibly high price for that. And I respect the work that they did. But at the same time, I think we need to be aware as journalists and citizens that there are profoundly big questions about, does journalism often do harm? Does bringing this kind of information to people, yes, it's informative, but does it make people feel overwhelmed? Does it make them feel helpless? Does it make them feel like they can't do anything? Does it make them switch off and want to read about, you know, Kim Kardashian? And I say that sort of partly as a joke, but also seriously, because there are definitely questions of how we as investigative journalists present information, what we report, how we report it. I guess for me, over the years, how I've managed it is, yes, I go to difficult places, but for me, it's always important, and this book does this, and future projects will as well, show people and individuals and groups who are resisting, who are challenging a status quo or a certain narrative. So that could be a lot of my work over the years about, say, Israel-Palestine, or, you know, people, Jewish people, for example, who question a very blind pro-Israel narrative, or other positions around controversial questions. That, to me, is important, right?
Anthony, give us an example of one person, a family, someone who you met in your travels who profoundly inspired you.
There were people in Bougainville in Papua New Guinea. There was a family who were deeply suffered from the war, the civil war. I spent time with a young woman who was in her early 20s, so she was a young child during the war. Her family suffered. Her father was killed, and she's now working in a small village in Bougainville. Started up a very small school, teaching kids before they go to, I guess, proper school, basic, you know, reading, writing, etc., and is actively involved in campaigning against the reopening of this huge Rio Tinto mine, knowing that there's been no compensation for the last time. And people like that, families like that, don't really get much press in the West. In fact, they get no press. And to me, I think journalists, what we can do if we're doing our job, is to bring those stories to people. Ultimately, you can't, you know, force people to care about Papua New Guinea or Afghanistan. And often these issues don't get a lot of press. Afghanistan's always in the media, so is Palestine. But I think often the perspectives we hear is very much, it's always at war, every side is crazy, no one quite knows who's right and who's wrong. And often these issues are nuanced, I accept that. But to me, it was this family, her name was Thea Neela. She was a very
Thea Neela,
articulate young woman. And for me, someone like her and her partner were an inspiring example of a new generation who are very different to the current leadership in PNG. And I hope she has ambitions to be Prime Minister one day, and I hope that she gets that chance.
And finally, you've just been around the world again, but also to the US. What were you looking at there?
Yeah, I'm working on a new book, which will be out next year with Verso. It's a US and UK publisher about disaster capitalism. So, yes, I'm still on the same issue, but expanding it. So the countries we've just been talking about, and also US, UK and Greece. So
what's happening
UK,
in the US?
US, there is, as listeners will be aware, huge issues over immigration. There are roughly 11 million, as they call them, undocumented immigrants living in the US. Huge surge of particularly children in the last 6-12 months who are flooding across the border, coming from Honduras and Mexico. And I spent time looking at the privatized nature of that. So a lot of the immigration centers, huge centers, are run for profit by prison corporations. So all the same issues. Run like prisons, abuse like prisons, not a lot of care. I spent time in Georgia, in the middle of Georgia, in the middle of nowhere, in one of the poorest towns in that state called Lumpkin, with one of the largest immigration centers in the US. It houses roughly 2,000 people, all men, and I said mostly from Latin America, South America. So I was there really trying to investigate that side of the argument. We hear a lot about immigration in the US, and the Obama administration has talked about some kind of reform, which is a long time coming. But the side of it is that, for example, I'll give one very short example. There's an immigration quota that came into place in 2007, put through by the US Congress, little understood or little known, that says that every night, there must be at least 34,000 immigrants behind bars in America, every night. And the effect of that was because of very effective lobbying by Immigration and Private Prison Corporation. So what does that mean in practice? It means that across the country, the organization who are tasked to do that make sure, I mean, number goes up and down, but it's roughly 34,000 every night at least, are behind bars, immigrants. That's the practical reality, I think, of a system that is broken, where you have lobbying, such effective lobbying, that you have like this random number put into place of individuals. So I was spending time hearing a lot of these people's stories. Mm. And people are fleeing often very, very difficult situations. And I think Obama probably will put through some kind of reform later on this year. But when you have so many people coming across the border, the system simply can't cope.